From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start in Mississippi, where 680 mostly Latino undocumented immigrants were arrested yesterday at several poultry plants around Jackson. Schools scrambled to make sure kids had someone to go home to. 11-year-old Magdalena Gomez Gregorio's father was taken.
Government, please put your heart. Let my parents be free here with everybody else, please.
That tape from WJTV. The mayor of Jackson is Chokwe Lumumba. Mr. Mayor, are you hearing voices like this?
Absolutely. We're hearing a cry from our community, a cry of disgust, a cry that sees this poor display of humanity. While these factories are not in Jackson, they are only a short distance away. Many of these individuals live near or in the city of Jackson, more than likely. And so I think that we can't stand idly by and see this this human rights crisis take place.
Well, let's talk about the practical concerns first. This was the first day of school, so as has happened with past raids, schools had a scramble to make sure children had someone to go home to. Almost 700 workers at a couple of plants. This is 40 miles east of Jackson. These were longtime residents, hardworking. That's tough work, processing chicken, any kind of meat. And there's a sign outside one of the plants saying they're hiring. Well, what do you think the economic consequences will be? Will those plants be able to get 700 workers who are not undocumented?
It would appear to be an effort of cutting off your nose to spite your face. As we see the state government supporting these actions, it will have a significant impact on the economics of this state. And you know, what it all flows from is a horrible economic policy where we pit people against one another, suggesting that you have a population that are taking people's jobs. And I suggest that if it was your job, no one could take it. Ultimately, what is taking place is that you have several groups of people that are being taken advantage of. And instead of recognizing the common struggle that we bear, we often are found in fruitless arguments or fruitless disputes with one another.
Well, we've heard from in the past from owners of these plants that they can't get people to do these really, really tough, not pleasant jobs. But should employers be more responsible here? I mean, we're reading in the Clarion Ledger that the former owner of a Tennessee plant that was raided last year was sentenced just last month to 18 months in prison for immigration violations. The law is the law, Mr. Mayor, and these employers had to know that they were hiring undocumented workers. You know, is perhaps there's some fault there?
Yeah, well, having and I will speak to the employers, but having some knowledge before I took on the role of mayor, I worked in a law firm where we represented the Mississippi Immigrants Rights Alliance. Often it is American companies that go over to our neighboring countries and promise opportunity to people. Many of these people give up their life savings to come over here because they're promised an opportunity only to be, you know, hailed under the threat of being sent back after everything that they've worked for is now depleted. They've raised families to be sent back and you know, just in a completely disarming circumstance. And so once you understand that, then you do realize that, yeah, employers need to be held responsible, but employers need to be held responsible for trying to have slave labor. They need to be held responsible for not offering living wages. And so what we are doing are we're prosecuting the victims in this case.
Well, Mr. Mayor, you're calling on churches to become safe havens. Now, your city is already a sanctuary city. That means that you have an ordinance that prohibits the police from gathering information on someone's immigration status. You want the federal ICE officials to handle that so that your police can have the trust of the communities to do their policing. That's what a sanctuary city is. But you're actually asking churches now to become safe havens. Aren't you feeding into the problem, though, because you are then, you know, telling undocumented immigrants, you know, come take refuge in our churches? But, you know, as you just said, they will also they will still face the threat of deportation. I mean, aren't you giving them a false sense of hope if the laws are still the way they are?
What I'm doing is calling on the churches to help people in need. I believe that that should be the pursuit of every church, you know, and any law that would support anything to the contrary is a bad law.
That's Chokwe Lumumba, mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Mayor Lumumba, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, the impacts of last weekend's mass shootings are being felt far beyond El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. Yesterday, the headquarters of USA Today outside Washington, D.C. was evacuated after authorities received an unconfirmed report of a gunman in the building. Police later said there was no evidence a crime had occurred. And on Tuesday, the sound of a backfiring dirt bike sent hundreds of people fleeing New York City's Times Square. Many mistook the sounds for gunshots and took shelter in nearby buildings, including Broadway theaters. Similar scares happened at a mall in Utah and a Walmart in Louisiana. Joining us now is Arthur Evans, CEO of the American Psychological Association. And Arthur Evans, does it surprise you that those incidents occurred soon after two mass shootings?
Well, it's not surprising. What happens in these kinds of traumatic events is that people become much more anxious. They become hypervigilant. And I think a couple of characteristics, particularly about the Walmart incident, is that this was a place that many people frequent. And so when people are observing these kinds of horrific events and they're in far off places or places that they don't frequent, that's one thing. But when you talk about a Walmart, a place that many, many Americans go, it really brings it home and it makes it more likely in people's minds that these kinds of events could happen to them.
People were commenting on Twitter that the whole country has PTSD. Do you think that there's something to that, that people are experiencing a form of trauma similar to the one experienced by people who witness a mass shooting, even if they themselves were never in danger?
Well, we know that people who experience or witness an event, they don't have to be a participant in the event, can feel the effects of those kinds of events. We, in the field, we talk about vicarious trauma. And that's a very real phenomenon. And we know that people will often develop clinical symptoms in the aftermath of just simply witnessing an event. A lot of that depends on the person, their vulnerabilities at the time that they witnessed the event, and a lot of other characteristics, but it is not unreasonable. And in fact, we know that many people will experience some effects from simply witnessing these kinds of events.
I have to say that the one place where I often take at least a moment to think about the possibility of something terrible happening is whenever I go see a movie in the movie theater, because we've seen, of course, the Aurora theater shooting. And you can just imagine that happening now that we know what it's like when that does happen. Is there a way for us to kind of better put this in context and not be so afraid when we go out in public when we know that these things are happening so frequently?
Right. Well, I think one thing to note is the statistical probability. And we know from actually a lot of psychological research that as people, we're not really good judges of the likelihood that something will happen to us. Many people are deathly afraid of flying because of their fear of being in a plane crash. But statistically, that's much less likely to happen than being in a car accident. So as people, we're not really good judges of that. One of the things that is important, I think, as you're pointing out, is for people to have a more realistic understanding of the likelihood that these kinds of events happen. As horrific as they are, it's still statistically very improbable that someone is going to be in one of those kinds of events. And beyond that, it's important for people to do common sense things to make sure that in the unlikely event that one of these things should happen, they know what to do. It's just like being on an airplane. They say, in the unlikely event that we lose air pressure, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of things that can help people feel safer and more at ease in some of these situations.
Is there something about how the media cover mass shootings that contributes to the sense of anxiety among the public?
Well, we know that the more dramatic that an event is to people, that it's going to have a greater impact. One of the things that we always suggest is that people limit the amount of time that they're spending watching these kinds of news shows. You have some shows that some networks that will play over and over and over these kinds of events. And if someone is watching this all day for multiple days, they're going to be affected by it.
Do you think that this is doing something to our national psyche? Is it making us more risk averse, for example?
I don't know about risk averse, but it's clear that the more these events happen, the more they're happening in places that people frequent and people believe they could be in, it's going to have an impact. The one thing that I do think is important to remember in all of this is that we know from a lot of research that most people are going to be fine, even the people who are directly involved in these kinds of events. They're going to bounce back. But we also know that a certain percentage of people are not going to be fine. And that's okay. That's why we have professionals that can intervene and to help people through those situations.
That is Arthur Evans, CEO of the American Psychological Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
A new report out today from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, reveals just how much our use and management of land around the world could hasten and intensify the effects of climate change. There is particular concern about the management of the world's largest tropical rainforest. Brazil's portion of the Amazon is experiencing a significant rise in deforestation since its populist president, Jair Bolsonaro, took office 7 months ago. Joining us now is Carlos Nobre, a climate scientist in Brazil. He's on Skype from Sao Paulo. Carlos, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Well, and first of all, as someone who has extensively studied the Amazon and the climate impacts of deforestation, how alarming is what we're seeing now?
We are seeing a spike in deforestation rates in the Amazon, actually not in the last month or 2 months. This has been going on for a few years. However, in the last 12 months, the deforestation rates increased over 40% compared to the preceding 12 months. So this is really a red light of warning that deforestation rates are apparently without any control.
And is that spike just because of President Bolsonaro's rollback of environmental protections?
That spike is due to many reasons. Let's say the weakening of environmental legislation did not start in the last 7 months under President Bolsonaro's government. It started a few years back. However, now there is this perception that the environmental legislation will disappear.
How is it impacting the wildlife and the indigenous people that live in the Amazon?
It may impact very, very profoundly both the wildlife and also indigenous people, particularly with these ideas that indigenous lands should be occupied with economic activities such as mining, gold digging, and also some ideas of converting indigenous land into cattle ranches and things like that. So that is really putting indigenous lands under a tremendous threat that we did not see since the military government in 1970s and 80s.
Help us understand, though, why the president of Brazil and obviously many of his supporters believe that this place, the Amazon, that is so unique in the world and such an important ecosystem, would be better used for farming, mining, gold digging, or any other economic development?
Brazil has been under economic recession for several years, and the growth rate of economy is still very low, much lower than everyone expected. So I think the policies, government policies, are short-sighted in trying to see ways to generate economic gains on a very short vision for the future, because they are unable to see the greatest potential of the Amazon forest, which is its biodiversity. Biodiversity in the 21st century has a tremendous, infinite economic potential, tapping into the biological assets of the forest. But that requires science and technology. That requires some time to develop this new bioeconomy. And this government and preceding governments as well, they had a very short-sighted vision of grabbing short-term profits, and they cannot see anything but mining and agriculture.
Well, and in fact, the director of the Brazilian government agency that monitors the Amazon was fired last week following the release of preliminary data on the rate of deforestation. Bolsonaro accused Ricardo Galvão of lying about the numbers, and his departure is seen to many as Bolsonaro's way of silencing the truth. Do you think that's what's happening here, silencing the truth?
Yes, this is very bad for the National Institute for Space Research. Professor Ricardo Galvão was one of the top Brazilian scientists, a physicist. He got his PhD at MIT. So this really sends a very bad sign that government will be managed only for people who are giving good news. But of course, you know, bad news are happening all the time.
How do Brazilians feel right now about the rise of deforestation of the Amazon?
It's interesting because overall, the majority of the Brazilians, including 85% of the people living in the Amazon, are against Amazon deforestation. So in a true democracy, the voice of the people should be heard, and government certainly should carry out policies to reduce deforestation in the Amazon, particularly considering that about 80% of deforestation in the Amazon is illegal. So it's not abiding by the Brazilian law.
So obviously this is something that affects Brazil, but the Amazon is also a crucial player in getting carbon out of the atmosphere. Should the rest of the world have a say in what happens to this forest?
I think the rest of the world should have a say about what's happening to all of the Amazon forest. You know, 9 countries have tropical forests in the Amazon. Deforestation rates are increasing tremendously in Brazil, but also in Colombia, and also more moderately in other Amazonian countries. So there should be certainly a global movement to protect the tropical forests, not only the Amazon, but also equatorial Africa, Southeast Asia. But there should be a global movement to force Amazonian countries to find policies that would reduce deforestation, and more than that, really to withdraw carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So the Amazon is playing this very important role, removing up to 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere every year. So we should really have a program to restore perhaps 300,000 to 500,000 square kilometers of deforested areas, which are really under very, very low productivity agriculture.
That is Carlos Nobre, who is a climate scientist in Brazil. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now to the world of genetics, which can tell us a lot about our health risks. In Nevada, researchers are building a huge genetic database in an attempt to tell us more than we've ever known before. Noah Glick from KUNR reports.
I meet up with Jordan Steitler in a Reno coffee shop. She's a mom to a 2-year-old boy with another kid on the way, a girl. She recently got some interesting information about her family.
I'm related to Jesse James, the outlaw, which I think a lot of people are. It's kind of weird.
Steitler discovered this connection after she took part in what's called the Healthy Nevada Project. This statewide initiative asks participants to provide a sample of their saliva to determine a genetic blueprint. In return, they get free ancestry results and a genetic health screening. It's how Steitler discovered that, in addition to some interesting relatives, she has a genetic disorder called familial hypercholesterolemia, or FH. Basically, she has high cholesterol that's unaffected by diet and exercise.
We're not, like, dwelling on it. We're not upset about it. Like, it's just something that I have, and we're gonna fix it.
Since getting the results, she's drastically changed her lifestyle. She's switched to a plant-based diet and exercises more regularly now to avoid making her cholesterol level even worse. But the real finding for her has to do with something a little more personal. Steitler lost her dad about 10 years ago, the victim of a stroke at age 45.
I always say that we felt like my family was kind of cursed because, you know, there are men who are passing away really young, and it's scary, and we never really truly knew why, and this could be why.
Genetics offers a lot to the basic researchers.
That's Dr. Joseph Jimsky. He's the principal investigator for the project. Jimsky says the project started as an idea between the state-funded Desert Research Institute, an environmental research organization, and Renown Health, a Reno-based not-for-profit healthcare network. Together, the two wanted to understand how knowing your genetic information could help improve health by changing your behavior.
And that, to me, is the trillion-dollar question.
For now, the study is looking for three gene variants that are linked to colon cancer, high cholesterol, and breast and ovarian cancer.
For the 1.25% of the population that has one of those three conditions, we could do something about it before it's too late.
The Healthy Nevada Project kicked off about 3 years ago. It has around 50,000 participants now, but its aim is to eventually reach 1 million people across the state. Anyone can sign up, which is what makes it the largest community-based population health study of its kind in the world. But it's a lot of personal data to have on file.
This doesn't get more personal than your DNA.
That's Dr. Anthony Slonim, the president and CEO of Renown Health.
So we have in the project a tremendous responsibility in assuring that we are protecting that with the utmost care.
To do that, the project has added several security layers. Slonim says no one involved in the project has access to both genetic data and personal health information. And unlike direct-to-consumer genetic tests like Ancestry.com, participants in the Healthy Nevada Project are protected by a certificate of confidentiality from the National Institute of Health. That means law enforcement and other entities can't get access to the information. DNA sequencing company Helix provides the genetic analysis for the project. Co-founder Justin Cao says genetic testing has gotten significantly cheaper. That means these kinds of tests can be done more.
It's just another data layer, just like your annual physical, just like an annual cholesterol test, where it's another data point your physician will use to help keep you healthier.
Cao sees a future where physicians could search your digital genetic profile to find the right mix of treatments and medications based on your specific genes. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick.
The NCAAs, the college athletics decision makers, has announced new rules for certifying agents who want to represent college athletes. Among other requirements, the NCAA is now asking that all agents have a bachelor's degree. Some are calling this rule the Rich Paul rule for the powerful agent who represents basketball legend LeBron James, among others. Rich Paul doesn't have a degree. He's an African-American, relatively new in this business. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, I'm so sorry to hit this so directly on the nose, but some people are. They're wondering, is there some kind of racial element here? What's going on?
Oh, I wouldn't put it past the NCAA to be at least clueless when it comes to the implications of its policies. Now, let's just go back half a step and explain what this really is about.
Right.
If a player goes last 4 years in college and goes into the draft, or even if a player is great, Zion Williamson goes 1 year, goes into the draft, gets taken, he's going to hire whatever agent he wants because he's not going back to college. But there's another class of players that might want to put their toe in the water, and they might want to declare eligible for a draft, and they might want to get an agent to help guide them in this process. A couple years ago, they were able to do that, but once they hire, they were able to say, well, maybe I'm eligible, but once they hired an agent, that's it. Their eligibility was gone. So now the NCAA is loosening its rules forced by an off-season cheating scandal and some recommendations by Condoleezza Rice. Well, maybe we could let these kids who are testing the waters hire an agent. That could help. But what kind of agents? And then they come in and they describe, they to certify an agent, the NCAA says, among other things, you have to have been certified by the NBA for 3 years and have insurance and also a bachelor's degree. And then people said, you know, the greatest athlete, the greatest agent in the sport would not qualify. That seems weird.
Wayne, we should say he is grandfathered, which is kind of even weirder. He's grandfathered since he's already, you know, doing this work. But, you know, right. L.A. Laker LeBron James and Oklahoma City Thunder's Chris Paul have both come out against this rule. And Chris Paul arguing, you know, maybe if not racist, this is a little elitist because life experience is often as valuable as a diploma. Witness Rich Paul.
Yes, yes. And also, I was thinking about this. The greatest Hollywood mogul of all time, Lou Wasserman, who made his name as an agent, was only a high school graduate, okay? So he didn't go to college. I could understand, though, to perhaps bend over backwards. You know, the C in NCAA does stand for collegiate.
Right.
So maybe they would favor or take as a proxy a college degree as equaling more than it does. But that's kind of their whole hustle, right?
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
a cartel. They're trying to consolidate their power. And one of the statements they're trying to make is, and a college degree is proof that you could continue on in this game. Although I do agree with the players. I do agree with the powerful agents. It's a poor proxy for someone who will steer an athlete correctly.
Well, and they're battling the NBA right now, which is proposing lowering the draft eligibility age to 18, which eliminates college, which a lot of people are against, so maybe that factors into this as well. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Rich Paul, again, an example of how, you know, you can sometimes do it without college. Mike, thank you.
Yeah, if you're friends with LeBron, you're
That's
welcome.
If you caught the show yesterday, you heard part of our conversation with two veterans who are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, something 11 to 20% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are dealing with. Isaiah James served in the Army and deployed three times, twice to Iraq, once to Afghanistan. Fidel Gomez-Torres served in the Navy and did one tour of duty in Afghanistan. Isaiah was close to suicide at one point because of his PTSD. Fidel said he started to struggle soon after he came home in 2011, but he was very reluctant to admit it.
I feel like there was such a stigma, and still is, around having PTSD. There is this idea of brokenness that you carry. And for me, I've always been high functioning. I've always been an overachiever. So I was very stubborn and I was very resistant. Nevertheless, I still saw the symptoms. And deep inside, whenever I allowed myself to be honest, I would tell myself, I keep on saying I'm okay, but I don't think that I am.
Both men have made the difficult decision to seek mental health care, but that's just the first step toward getting better. I asked Isaiah if he feels he's getting the help he needs from the VA.
100% without equivocation, yes.
Fidel?
I had a couple of hiccups. I think that the intentions are in the right place. But I also know that my VA has been limited. And because of that, I had to play around with my treatment at first, which made it difficult. You know, you want to go in there, you want consistency, you want something that feels good, but is going to be lasting. And that wasn't the case for me. You know, initially I was recommended acupuncture, just kind of like trying to get my feet wet. And it was supposed to be every 2 weeks, but, you know, there weren't enough acupuncturists available to see me every 2 weeks. So it wasn't a cadence that I could follow. So I kept on hearing back from the VA saying, your appointment has been canceled. We have to reschedule you. So it was a little difficult. Eventually, they got it, you know, right. But I can definitely say that the resources are not always there.
Do you think that there are people who come back from combat situations in these wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan who don't deal with PTSD? Or do you think everybody does to some degree? Isaiah, I'll start with you.
To some degree, I would say, yes, everybody does. They like Fidel said, they may not know what it is or they may not know how to quantify it, but there is no person that I know that can go into war. And most people, they only see war, you know, extemporaneously from the outside. But it's a whole different animal when you're actually there and mm-hmm. in it. And you cannot see that as a human being. You cannot be put in those situations or be around that environment for a year at a time in the Army's case and not come back with some kind of PTSD.
Fidel, when you live your civilian life here in the United States, do you feel like Americans understand what you have gone through?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Do you ever talk about it with people?
Not really. I think it's a difficult conversation to have with civilians. I think that unless you've experienced it, you really have no points of reference. So, you know, I can tell someone, you know, this is what my experience was. And there is a distance and almost kind of like, oh, I don't know. I feel like sometimes people romanticize service and war stories in a way that makes it seem like, okay, that this is great. You know, it's great. Well, you know, you went out and you served. Yeah, I don't regret going out and serving. This is my country. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that people realize what happens when you go. And I don't think that people realize what happens when you come back. And I don't think that enough conversations, honest conversations, are had about the toll and the cost of war, not just in lives that don't come back, but in lives that come back and are broken.
Isaiah, what do you think? When you relate with people who have not served in this country, do you think that they have any sense of what you've been through?
Absolutely not. I don't really talk to people who haven't served about my experiences. I don't really let people know too often that I was even in the service. Like I said before, my lovely wife, I've opened up to her about some of my experiences, but as Fidel said, there's no point of reference. You know, I mean, some of the things that I've seen and done, there's no point of reference that I could tell you about seeing, you know, people actually blown into pieces. There's no point of reference that I could, you know, tell people about having at 18 years old to make a decision to take a human life or have your life be taken and be put in that position. Have to do it day in and day out and day in and day out. It changes you. So there's no way I think I could get people who haven't served to actually understand. They may understand on the surface, like Fidel said, romanticize it and think about, you know, service is this great thing, but they don't understand the human toll that it takes on you just being in war.
What would each of you say to the government in Washington about what the military needs right now or what veterans need right now if they're listening? Fidel.
I don't think that the military needs much. You know, I think that we often take pride in having the best military or the greatest military, the mightiest military. We can't be mighty and also be insufficient. You have to pick one. I think that the greatest need is in how America treats its veterans when they come back. I walk down Newbury Street here in Boston and you see homeless people holding up signs saying that they served in this war and they served in that war. There should be no person that serves this country, puts their life on the line and is out holding a sign on cardboard, you know, in the streets, you mm-hmm. know, without a home, without food. That should never be the case.
Isaiah?
I think that and a $20 trillion economy is out, such as ours, I think it's my duty as a veteran to say that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. As not only do veterans need more resources, but we can give those resources to all people in the country in need. I would say that Congress needs to have an honest conversation about where we allocate those resources. Because right now we're spending 10 times more on defense than we are education. So we're prioritizing war and warmongering more so than we're prioritizing education and educating the next generation. And I think Congress needs to have that honest conversation. We cannot be at war with the world. All great empires have fallen, the Romans, the Greeks, the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. We're stretching ourselves too thin. And I see us going down a path that if which we do not correct ourselves, will have disastrous consequences. So I think we need to get our house in order, pull some of those funds back from an overbloated military budget, and spend them on people at home.
Okay, I want to ask each of you one final question, which is, what would you say to veterans who may be listening to this who have not taken the steps to get help that both of you have, Fidel?
I would say be honest with yourself. You know, you don't have to be a hero. You don't have to project that you are okay if you're not. Be honest with yourself and stop being stubborn and refusing help. It's okay to need help. It's okay to get the help. It's amazing to heal. And I think that the moment that, you know, people start having honest conversations with what they can and cannot do, what they need and, you know, and the help that they, you know, want, there will be one step closer to healing.
Isaiah?
I would say to all my brothers and sisters who have served, you're not in this fight alone. I know it may seem like it at times, but there are truly people out there who care and want to help you. And there are people out there who have gone through the same experiences that you have. So please, we're losing too many of our brothers and sisters every day to suicide. Get the help that you need. The resources are there. You might have to go through some bureaucratic red tape, but do not choose a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
That is Army veteran Isaiah James and Navy veteran Fidel Gomez-Torres speaking with us about their service and also PTSD. Thanks to both of you. I'm so glad that both of you are getting the help that you need and that you talked about it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can hear our full conversation and find links to resources for veterans at hereandnow.org.
And we have some good news.
Good news. We almost never have good news.
I know. We have a new co-host. Tanya Mosley is joining us. Her first full broadcast will be tomorrow. Party hats are in order. Jeremy.
Party hats. And we want to take a moment now to get to know Tanya a little better so that you know her better. And she will be there with you all the time on Here and Now. Tanya, great to have you here with us.
Great to be here.
And you're going to be saying this very soon also, but welcome to Here and Now.
Welcome to Here and Now. I'm Tanya Mosley.
We practice it at home.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and the journey that brought you to this point.
Well, I know it's hard to believe because I look so young, but I have been in this business for about 25 years. I started off as a television reporter and anchor in several markets throughout the United States. And my last stint was at KQED in San Francisco. I was the Silicon Valley bureau chief and host.
Well, you know, it's funny because I am shocked that 25 years, but you did start even younger than you said. Yeah. I love this story. Jeremy, we know you hosted a radio program when you were 9.
Right. Treehouse Radio.
Treehouse Radio.
Right.
And Tanya, you were telling me that when you were 12, your grandpa, who loved newspapers, used to drive you to one every day.
Yes. So the Detroit Free Press had this program called Mentor for a Day that then graduated to an apprenticeship for young folks. But I was 12 years old and I was a part of this program. And my grandfather would drive me there and I'd sit with journalists and do fact checks and things like that for them, going to the basement, looking at phone books, looking for spell checks.
Wait a minute, unpaid labor.
I know, right? We don't do that anymore. But just last night, my mother was telling me that she was looking through some of my grandfather's old things. He passed away in 2001, and she found that he had in a folder all of my writings, all of my articles starting at 12, neatly packed in there. And I know, he was a wonderful man who loved journalism, and he fueled that into me.
Well, he's smiling right now as you join us. I mean, what a inspirational story.
Well, and tell us, I mean, who or what inspires you? I know it's a kind of a cliche question, but answer it.
I know, I'm going to give kind of a cliche answer. But everyday people who are just doing it, who are getting up every day, who are doing it really inspire me. I was talking to Nathaniel, who works here at the front desk here in Boston, and it was 7:30 in the morning, and he was sitting there with his breakfast. And I said, Nathaniel, what are you doing here so early? And he said, I get here a half an hour early so I can make sure everything's in place. And that kind of stuff inspires me. It's why I'm a journalist. It's why I'm so nosy. I want to know about people's lives.
Will you hear him play the drums in his
band? I know. He's a really great musician.
Well, actually, we were speaking the other day, and we were both inspired by a reporter a long time ago from New York, Melba Tolliver.
Yes,
who covered a White House wedding. I think it was a Nixon wedding. And
that's right. She wore an afro, even though her news director told her not to wear an afro to the wedding to cover it. And she did anyway. She was one of my inspirations, longtime inspirations. You know, every young Black girl is inspired by Oprah. So, you know, Oprah's like my aunt, even though she doesn't want to be called that.
And Melba Tolliver was before that. Long before that.
And
tell us a little bit about your podcast and some of the things that you have covered. You have all different interests.
Sure. So I have a podcast called Truth Be Told, which is an advice show for people of color. And we really delve into some of the most pressing issues that Black and brown people deal with in this country. We have these safe space conversations that are full of laughter, full of tears, and I really enjoy producing it.
And what other areas? I mean, what other areas of reporting?
Yeah, what other areas of reporting interest you the most?
Well, as you know, I was in the Silicon Valley as a Silicon Valley bureau chief, and what really was interesting to me is the disparities around technology, how we're a connected society, and we expect for that everyone is connected. But there are pockets throughout the United States where people are literally not connected to the internet. They don't have the capabilities to do homework if they're in education, those types of things. So I look forward to delving into that as we move forward.
Now, as you know, you will be connected to the internet as a host of Here Now. You're going to be on it all the time, and you're going to be doing how many interviews a day, Robin? You know, 10 interviews a day or something like that. What excites / scares you most about joining us here at Here and Now?
Oh, that is a good question. I think what excites me is being a part of an important discussion every day. I've always said that information is the pathway to liberation. It's the pathway, once you know about what's happening in the world around you, you can make informed decisions. And we have a very important role to provide people with context and understanding and language as they move through the world.
Well, and I always say that, you know, we live right now in the most powerful country on earth. We have a responsibility to know what is going on in the world, and that's what we try to do every day.
And I always say, Tanya Mosley, whatever you have planned from your perch in L.A., throw it out at about a little bit before noon East Coast time, because that's the one thing about this program. Everything changes.
That's how the news works,
everything,
right?
Everything changes. There will be a tweet, and anything you planned will go out the window.
And since you'll be based in L.A., you can send tacos. You can just send them across the country
to us. The best.
So, Tanya Mosley, we welcome you to the Here and Now family. We can't wait to work even more with you. We have so many other people who help us get the show on the air. Peter O'Dowd comes to mind. We're doing as much as we can to bring as much news in the midday to you and the morning.
Okay,
we
have to do the joint credits here, okay, Robin,
here we go.
Because now we've got all three of us here.
Okay,
go ahead.
Good. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. I'll be hosting from NPR West in Culver City.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
That sounded good.